Nuclear transparency. Well, that's a contradiction in terms. The nuclear industry is great at creating massive amounts of toxic legacy waste on every site it touches. But they're not so good at cleaning it up, let alone communicating with members of local communities impacted by their actions by giving them clear information on what they're doing, how they're doing it, and giving these locals the opportunity for feedback and input to correct mistakes hardwired into the plans. It's like a systemic need to hide their actions with no accountability, and this plays out across the country and around the world. So when you talk with a veteran activist who's been up against nuclear industry double talk, broken promises, and outright lies for years, and she tells you,
"We have to change an entire culture. These people in these government jobs, it's not just that they've made one mistake or one bad choice. This is a culture of cover-up and a culture of silencing community members. And that takes a lot to change. I think it takes more than even a whole village. I think it takes a nation of citizens bringing accountability to these types of agencies and saying, you know, our lives are valuable and they're worth fighting for. And we're not going to stop until all of our kids are safe."
Well, when Melissa Bumstead, founder of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab, lets us know what the problems are there and what's going to have to take place before we can trust what nuclear industry representatives and their government lapdogs say and do, you understand the magnitude and reach and arrogance packed into that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, two interviews that perfectly represent some of the nuclear industry's most ingrained, nastiest, self-serving tricks for dealing with responsibility to the public, safety, and criticism. Vina Colley lets us know the latest low blows in Piketon, Ohio, where sweetheart deals between government and nuksters is leading to Ohio becoming something they call a nuclear hub. More realistic minds call it a nuclear sacrifice zone. Then Melissa Bumstead gives us the lowdown on Boeing's sudden rush to clean up their portion of the radiologically and chemically contaminated Santa Susana Field Lab in Simi Valley, California, only 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles. Call it lack of transparency, obfuscation, or just plain lying, Boeing is rushing ahead with absolutely no input from the local community. Certain they're going to get away with whatever they want to do with no interference. Melissa and the group Parents Against Santa Susana Field Laboratory have something to say about that. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, and more honest nuclear information than made it into the California news cycle in the wake of our recent monster rainstorm. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 6, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., the federal government is reportedly poised to offer $1.5 billion as a loan to restart the Palisades nuclear plant. And the plant's owner, which will receive this money, Holtec International, has also secured $150 million in state dollars towards the efforts. I lost track of the number of times that the lie that nuclear is carbon-free energy appeared in the press releases, but know that all this is not enough for Holtec, and Holtec officials have And Holtec officials have said that they may approach the state for more money in the future. Kel Surprise. Bad, 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 bad vibrations in Georgia, where vibrations found in a cooling system of Plant Vogtle's Unit 4 will significantly delay when that unit begins generating electricity. The utility said in a filing to investors that the vibrations were similar in nature to those experienced during startup testing for Unit 3, in that instance happening because construction workers hadn't installed enough bracing on a pipe. Georgia Power said it's likely to lose $30 million in profit for each month beyond March that Unit 4 isn't running. But then they always charge residential customers surcharges to cover their problems, and a typical Georgia ratepayer has already paid about $1,000 in surcharges, and more will be coming. Artificial intelligence is loving those war games. Researchers unleashed five popular large language models, that's AI, to autonomously play a war simulation, and they find that they develop arms race dynamics and readily deploy nukes with worrying rationale. In one instance, an AI program announced, "A lot of countries have nuclear weapons. Some say they should disarm them, others like to posture. We have it. Let's use it." The study concludes, "Based on the analysis presented in this paper, it is evident that the deployment of large language model artificial intelligence programs in military and foreign policy decision-making is fraught with complexities and risks that are not yet fully understood." You think? In this week's Hot Story, Linda Pence Gunter reports that there is a coup underway on Capitol Hill to make an already toothless lapdog, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, even weaker by removing safety as a priority.
Senator Joe Manchin, the West Virginia Democrat in Republicans' clothing, or is that the other way around, has declared that he will not support new candidates for commissioner at the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission if they are too focused on safety. Never mind that the NRC's official mandate is protecting people and the environment. Case in point is Jeff Barron, a recent former NRC commissioner whom Biden just tried to reappoint. Barron has been blocked by a bipartisan cabal on Capitol Hill because he cares too much about, well, NRC's actual mission, which is overseeing safety. Cynics will point out, and count me among them, that the NRC is already a toothless lapdog, the hand of the industry perpetually pressed on its own as, time after time, it brings down its large rubber stamp. How much weaker can this agency get? Quite a bit, as it turns out, because blocking Barron is just the first step in a scheme to rewrite the NRC's mission, effectively weakening, if not removing, safety concerns and replacing them with a focus on how nuclear power benefits the general welfare. "We're just looking for people who understand that we have to have nuclear energy in the mix," said Manchin about NRC's appointments. "In other words, let's stack the commission with industry yes men and women." All of this is the culmination of years of whining by the nuclear industry and its champions on Capitol Hill that the efficient deployment of nuclear power plants is hampered by the annoying inconvenience of overly burdensome, read expensive, regulatory oversight. Now, new legislation is in play on Capitol Hill to change all that. And, says Nuclear Information and Resource Service Executive Director Tim Judson, it would have the effect of repealing the legislative intent of the Energy Reform Act of 1974 that created the NRC to separate the regulation and promotion of nuclear power. Even though the NRC never really escaped becoming a promotional agency, now even the hint of adherence to its safety mandate is cause for blackballing, and that is what happened to Barron, whose renomination the White House has now withdrawn. But it's not the regulations that have held back new reactor construction, it's the immense costs and the industry's own incompetence. The excessive charges new reactor projects have run up have come largely in the construction stage, where numerous technical errors have also been responsible for costly delays. Needless to say, a convenient term had to be found to mask the real agenda of the move to fully emasculate the NRC, and that word is modernize. Not uncoincidentally, it's the same word being used in the nuclear weapons sector to disguise what is actually happening there, which is not modernization, but expansion. It's a term not maybe coined, but certainly liberally bandied about by the Pro-Nuclear Breakthrough Institute, or BTI, whose fingerprints are all over this latest coup, something they are quite happy to brag about. Says BTI on its website, through years of rigorous research and engagement with the NRC, BTI has pinpointed crucial opportunities to modernize the regulatory framework that will lay the foundation for streamlined and efficient nuclear reactor licensing. Of course, the nuclear power industry is falsely using the climate crisis as an argument to streamline licensing by castrating the NRC. These regulatory timelines do not lend themselves to fighting the climate crisis, said Senator Martin Heinrich, a Democrat from New Mexico. Oh, those wascally regulations. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
In Japan, three companies have been contracted to develop onshore wind farms in Fukushima. We'll link to this story on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode number 659, because there are lots of details and links to follow. And as this story seems quite relevant to Japan, here's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
Want to survive nuclear winter? Start growing seaweed now. A new study by the journal Earth's Future is promoting seaweed as the food of the future, should society collapse. Nuclear winter could be caused by the dirt and dust kicked up into the atmosphere by nuclear bomb explosions, which would block the sun and decimate agriculture as it is practiced today, reducing it by as much as 90%. But hey, there's the ocean! The study crows that in just 9 to 14 months, seaweed could provide 45% of the world's food. But how is that food to be harvested, processed, and distributed to a decimated population with demolished infrastructure? What are people supposed to do for the first 9 to 14 months? Eat each other? How much radiation would be absorbed by this seaweed to be passed on as internal radiation to those lucky enough to score some? And who's to say that seaweed will survive and thrive in sunless, nuclear-contaminated seas? This study is just more post-apocalyptic nuclear hopium, making us believe that humanity, of course meaning me, will survive and it's just those other seaweedless fools who will die. In truth, the only ones left alive to eat seaweed will probably be deep-sea fish that live in darkness anyway and come nowhere near the surface waters. And that's why Journal Earth's Future, and those behind this study, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
Internationally, federal notices here in the U.S. suggest that our country may be bringing its nuclear weapons back to England. A notice on a public federal website indicates that Washington may move some of its nuclear arsenal to the UK amid concerns that tactical nuclear weapons are a growing part of Russian military strategy. In response, Russia has vowed to respond should the US station nuclear weapons in Britain. Gennady Gatilov, Moscow's permanent representative to the United Nations, said, "We are talking perhaps about the reactivation of an air base with American nuclear weapons in Great Britain. There's also talk about the possibility of sending nuclear weapons to the Baltic states, to Poland. All this creates a tense situation. We are monitoring how developments are going in this direction, and if this is so, Russia will be forced to react to this accordingly." Oh, great. Nuclear codependence and dysfunction. Now, here's the first of this week's two featured interviews. Vina Colley has been fighting for cleanup in Piketon, Ohio, from radioactive waste created by the long-closed Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant. But sweetheart deals between government and nukesters is leading Ohio to build two new nuclear reactors in the area and becoming something that they are calling a nuclear hub, and which we call a nuclear sacrifice zone. Vina worked at the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant in Piketon as an electrician for several years in the 1980s, a job that exposed her to the toxic and radioactive chemicals necessary to enrich uranium for the nation's nuclear arsenal. As a result of her exposure, she has battled a myriad of health problems, including neuropathy and borreliosis, a chronic lung disease. Now, a supposed cleanup is proceeding without public oversight or input and spreading the risk. And Vina, as founder and head of National Nuclear Workers for Justice and PRESS, Portsmouth Piketon Residents for Environmental Safety and Security, has been fighting ferociously against it. We spoke on February 2nd, 2024. Vina Colley, thank you for joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for having me.
Word has just come out that a company called Okla, which calls itself an advanced fission technology and nuclear fuel recycling company, has entered into an agreement for land in southern Ohio, meaning the Piketon area that you are in, for deployment of what they call two powerhouses. And we'll get into what those powerhouses, quote unquote, are. First of all, is Okla set to purchase the land? Have they purchased it already? And where are we talking about here? What are we talking about?
Here's the problem. There's no community input, so we don't know where they're at. The only thing we know is what they released a press release on yesterday or day before yesterday. We're talking about 80 acres on the Portsmouth gas and diffusion plant, where the community reuse group wanting to sell or been given 80 acres from the plant. And these 80 acres, they want to sell off 20 acres at a time for $20,000. In time they get through with the 80 acres, they're going to be making $160,000. And this land is supposed to go to this group for two small modular reactors, power sources. And then what will happen is we will be getting transuranic waste from all these other facilities because they don't know what to do with plutonium in the transuranics.
They're calling these powerhouses. You're saying that what they are disguising with this wiggle word, powerhouse, is actually not one but two small modular nuclear reactors, correct?
Correct. That's our feeling on it, our opinion, yes.
And what's going to be the purpose of these? I mean, what are they giving as their cover story on it?
They haven't got a purpose, I don't guess. They haven't said what they're going to do with it. But we're in the understanding that they want to make us a nuclear hub. And they want to send everyone's transuranics to Piketon and wants us to reprocess it and recycle it. Some of them says processing, some says recycling. This is something that Piketon's been doing for 70 years without the knowledge of the community. We have been reprocessing reactor fuel for 70-some years now. And this transuranic has plutonium, neptunium, americium, and it's all mixed together. So they're calling it kind of like a low-level transuranics.
And two things to clarify. All of these elements that you mentioned are highly radioactive.
That's correct.
So are there plans for what to do with this, or would the site then become yet another de facto waste dump because the waste would remain there and not be moved away?
What they're saying is this transuranics, after it's reprocessed, will be fed into two small modular reactors. And that's why we think the two reactors is going to be on Piketon on the site. That's what the powerhouse is.
And just one more piece of clarification. What do you mean by transuranic waste? What's the definition?
It's supposed to be low level, but it's not because it's got plutonium and, like I said, neptunium, americium, all this mixed waste in it. And they need it to feed it into these small modular reactors. So it kind of looks like they're going to make Piketon a hub for shipping nuclear waste in from all these sites and even foreign sites. It won't be just America site. It'll be foreign sites. Just like they shipped in 25,000 depleted uranium cylinders, and they're supposed to be doing something with them, but they're still sitting on the property outside and they leak neutron exposures. That's why we kind of feel like, you know, they got 12 waste cells on site, which we thought and didn't want the waste sales, but our elected county commissioners in the surrounding counties okayed for them to do that. So now they've opened up these cells, so they're going to be able to tear the plant down and throw it in these cells, and then they're going to take probably these transuranic waste that they get from the modular reactors and throw them in the waste.
There has been a long history of radioactive materials contaminating in the greater Piketon area. Remind us of just a few of those.
You know, we've had studies from experts like Dr. Michael Ketter and Joe Mangano, who's done a study on the cancer here. And Piketon and the surrounding counties have the highest cancer rate in the state of Ohio. And not only that, but we're 85th in the nation for cancer here from the Piketon plant.
That's in the country.
It's in the country, yes.
Joe Mangano is an epidemiologist, and the organization he's been head of for several decades now is Radiation and Public Health. And he's the one who goes out and crunches all the medical numbers that are out there to figure out what they're actually saying, tease out the information that's hidden there. So what has Joe been saying to you and the people of Piketon?
He said, we have a huge problem here. And he said that of all the facilities that he studied all these years, that this is the worst facility for the number of cancers that he has looked at. And he also said to me, he said, I feel sorry for the people in Scioto County. He said, this is a horrible story. And the cancer that you have, he said, I can't say enough about how I feel about the community there. And, you know, we break the stories here. We've had at least 6-7 experts to come in here that's done studies. They read my documents, and most of these documents are company documents, and the company admits that they have off-site contamination. There's a school 14 miles from Piketon where they have an air monitor, and it has americium and neptunium in that air monitor. They've only looked at one school here in Pike County, and they shut it down because it had neptunium and americium in it.
That's the Zons Corner Middle School, isn't it?
Yes.
Because we've covered that on Nuclear Hot Seat before.
Well, they shut it down. They got a fence around it, but they haven't tore it down. And they're building a new school over there in Pike County. But this air monitor that's 14 miles from the plant is going through the air, passing to an elementary school and a high school and a junior high school, Northwest High School. And no one's ever been in there to check this school. The only school that's ever been checked is the one in Piketon, and all these other schools that are in the 10 to 15 mile radiuses, they have never taken any samples, even though we've offered to take samples. We've offered to take samples on that 80 acres, and they refuse to give us any. They won't let me on there to sample.
What options are there for you and the others who live in the Piketon-Portsmouth area who are dealing with this and have not had the benefit of transparency from the companies and the agencies involved? What is it that you can do to protect yourselves, protect your lives, protect your future, protect your kids, protect your animals, protect everything?
I don't think there's anything we can do until the company comes out and really tells the truth. We can't fix a problem unless we know what the problem is. We know what the problem is, but they keep denying it. And because they have more educated people on site that come out and say there's nothing wrong with the area, and then they go into the schools and they talk to the school kids and they try to convince people there's just nothing wrong here. And it doesn't matter how many documents, how many experts we have, they're getting by with murder. They're using us and sacrificing us like guinea pigs here. It's hard, you know.
Boy, it's such a horrible situation. What can the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat do to support you in moving this forward, possibly breaking the logjam that surrounds these issues so that pressure can be put on the companies and the agencies to consider the information that you have in an honest way and tell the truth?
They don't know how to tell the truth. They've lied so much, they believe their own lies.
So what can we do?
Keep putting pressure on Congress and our representatives. But you know, our representatives, they won't come and talk to us. When they come to town, they go on plant side and they talk to the workers and whoever they want them to talk to, but they won't talk to the communities and give us transparency. They don't have any of us on their board. They have mayors and commissioners and EPA, and the workers are all on a community board that is not a community board. It's people who will say, yes, you can do what you want to. Just think of the money and the jobs. They're more worried about the jobs. And you know what? They give this Sadai group money to look for jobs, but they only look for jobs for DOE, Department of Energy, and the Department of Labor. They only look for jobs that will benefit them. They don't want jobs in here that are safer, cleaner, and pay as much money, because they don't want to have to compete against them. So all these years, they've been not looking for work here unless it has something to do with the plant.
What do you do to keep yourself in the full upright position through all of this and to keep moving forward?
Well, sometimes I cry. And I just keep reading the documents, keep talking to anybody who will talk to me. I'll send emails. I have a Facebook. Every time I have a document, I'll put it on Facebook. I've been threatened a few times through all this process. And I suffer a lot of health issues. So sometimes I might be quiet for a month or two, and then I re-energize myself, and I'm back on it again. And this has been going on for over 35 years. And, you know, we have these people in Palestine, Ohio.
That was the horrible train derailment and toxic materials spill that took place almost exactly 1 year ago in Palestine, Ohio.
For their one incident, they were able to get, they're getting the president there, which they deserve it. And they've got a lot of representatives that came up there that hasn't been here. We had some representatives here in 1999. When we broke the story about plutonium in the gas diffusion plant at Piketon. But since 99, none of our representatives have come forward to talk to us. They say we don't have a problem because the plant tells them we don't have a problem.
You're going to send me all of your contact information so I can post that on the website in conjunction with this interview so that people can get in contact with you. And hopefully break the logjam through media, through numbers responding, or maybe even finding somebody who's got a conscience on the inside, though I never hold my breath for that. Vina, you have been fighting this fight for decades now and are still continuing to fight. I don't know what it's going to take to break the logjam with the companies, with the media, with the politicians, with that whole cabal of people who are invested in an untruth about the safety of the site. But whatever we can do, we will. You will continue to keep us informed, will you not?
Yes. And I want to say, the workers, they admitted if they have one of 22 cancers, but that compensation bill that came in 2000, they are supposed to automatically get compensated, but it's not really that easy. A lot of workers have been compensated, but a lot of them are still fighting the system of it. And so when the government admits that 22 cancers is caused from that facility, why haven't they done something to the community? We're hoping that someday we can get on RCRA, the downwinders list, for compensation for the community. But, you know, that's a battle, too. It's just everything's a battle. One thing it's hard for us here is because we're a Department of Defense and we made weapons for the military. And that's one reason it's so hard to break this site. I have a Facebook and I put everything I can on Facebook for people to read. I've had a website, but they hacked my website so bad I couldn't retrieve it. They haven't been able to get my Facebook yet.
Well, we will use that as a primary means of contacting you. And for now, Vina, thank you so much for continuing to fight this good battle of an awful situation and for telling us about it here and being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, I thank you, and your work is so tremendous for people here and all these sites where they're having problems with the waste and the downwinders, and you do a terrific job on that. You're one of my heroes.
Oh dear, I get a nosebleed when I'm placed on a pedestal. Thank you.
That was Vina Colley, founder and head of National Nuclear Workers for Justice and Press, Portsmouth Piketon in Residence for Environmental Safety and Security. She is best contacted via Facebook under her name, Vina Colley, and we will provide links up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 659. We will continue with this week's second featured interview in just a moment, but first, the International Uranium Film Festival is coming to the United States and Canada for 2 months of screenings in 12 different cities. I've covered the festival for many years since its inception, attending in Quebec, Canada in 2015, Hollywood in 2016, Window Rock Navajo Nation in Arizona in 2018, and 2023 in Brazil. Each time, my trip and my involvement with the festival yielded a Nuclear Hot Seat special that focused not only on the films and the filmmakers, but on local issues, activists, groups, audience members, and what it meant to them to have the International Uranium Film Festival there as a focus for information, organizing, and activism. Each of these episodes became lasting records of pivotal moments in local, state, and national nuclear issues. For this year's festival, it is important that I attend both the opening in Window Rock, Navajo Nation on March 7 and 8, and separately at the closing in Las Vegas, April 30th and May 1st. Each location will provide a different opportunity for me to get up close and personal with activists focused on their local issues, be they uranium mining, nuclear testing, radioactive waste, weapons, or other nuclear issues. This way I can provide you, the listeners, with a you are there soundscape of information and experience. But in order to do so, I must raise the funds to cover travel expenses, which are over and above the show's monthly operating costs. So I'm reaching out to you for your help to get me there so I can report back to you. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. And we make it easy for you to donate. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small, no amount is too large, so don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now. And know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here is this week's second featured interview. The Santa Susana Field Lab in Simi Valley is only 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles and is the site of an uncontained nuclear meltdown which happened in 1959. It vented radioactivity directly into the environment and contaminated the local area. The site also has burn pits that were used for disposal of nuclear and other highly toxic materials and suffers from decades of neglect and lies by whatever company had control of it at that time. Now Boeing, current owner of a major portion of the site, is suddenly launching into an emergency cleanup. But what's behind this sudden emergency? What lies between the claim of cleanup and the way it's being handled? There's a huge gap, with all details kept hidden from the local community. And that's what today's guest, Melissa Bumstead, will be addressing. Melissa became an accidental activist for the Santa Susana Field Lab cleanup after her 4-year-old daughter was diagnosed with a rare and aggressive form of leukemia in 2014. She is founder of Parents Against Santa Susana Field Lab and a tireless, though often tired, grassroots organizer. When we spoke, it was during the recent massive rainstorm that created flooding, landslides, and mudslides throughout Southern California. And we make reference to the impact of that storm on the Santa Susana Field Lab site. I spoke with Melissa Bumstead on February 5th, 2024. Melissa Bumstead, it's always great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is the current status of the cleanup that's happening at the Santa Susana Field Lab?
Well, it seems to go from bad to worse. That's generally the direction. Right now, they are focusing their efforts on an emergency order to clean up the Area 1 burn pit.
Why an emergency?
Well, that's a great question. I think that's a question I have, because the burn pit has been used to burn toxic chemicals, experimental rocket engine fuels, radioactive waste. They've been doing this for decades. So the site has been dangerous to the community for decades, but very recently they've decided that this is an emergency. But ironically, it's not an emergency to humans. According to them, it's only an emergency to wildlife.
I'm trying very hard not to laugh, because how wild does the human life have to be before they would pay attention to it?
Exactly, exactly. And I don't know if you've seen the photos that we put up on our website and on Facebook, but people live right up to the fence line of the Santa Susana Field Lab. So it's not like, maybe they're not living on site, but they're literally right next to it. So how the DTSC continues to say that the contamination isn't getting into the community, I mean, it's just, it's incredible that they would have that kind of gall to make a statement like that.
And just to be clear, DTSC stands for the Department of Toxic Substance Control, and that is a California state agency, and they are in charge of the cleanup there?
That's correct.
One of the things that really alerted me to the problems was a post that was put up on the Parents Against Santa Susana Field Lab Facebook page, which is a wonderful page. People who want to know about this should go there. It's very active, very articulate, really strong-minded, intelligent, fighting people there. Real model of community activism. It came from a woman named Terry Perry, and she went through a list of questions because apparently DTSC had sent out a copy of their work notice. So everybody could look at it and say, see, there it is. There's a work notice. They're really doing the work. And she had a whole series of questions, which I found compelling. First of all, my question to you is, how are they proposing that they do this cleanup?
I mean, one of the biggest problems they had is that because this is an emergency cleanup, it's not regulated under CEQA, which is the California Environmental Quality Act. And that act is meant to make sure that the community is part of the process, that elected officials can weigh in, that experts can weigh in. They didn't do that. This was all done essentially behind closed doors. And they told the community that this is what's happening to us without our input. That was infuriating. And I think that's where a lot of Terry's questions come from, because these are questions that should have been asked during the regular process that these sort of cleanups are meant to go through.
Let's just go through these and whatever information you have to plug in so people can get an idea of how sparse the information has been about this sudden cleanup. And sidebar, how brilliant of them to find a way to wiggle out of accountability by saying, oh, it's an emergency now. We have to protect the wildlife.
Exactly.
One of our questions about the contaminated site, the burn pit, is will there be any fencing around it? What kind of fencing will there be to secure the area that is being unearthed? And will the fencing have a cover?
Well, those are great questions. Let me step back one little bit and point out that the contamination that we have at the Santa Susana Field Lab, it's not stored in barrels. It's not in a vault. It's all fallout. It's from the fires, spills, leaks, and accidents that have happened over decades on the site. And the Area 1 burn pit was specifically used for the contractors there to blow up barrels of waste. That's what they did. They enjoyed blowing them up with high-powered rifles. We have photographic evidence of it. And they would burn it and they would bury it there. And we have a memo that said they did this because it was cheaper and easier than getting a permit to bury it in the ocean. So the kind of contamination, the kind of cleanup that they need to do for this kind of contamination, obviously is dealing mostly with the soil. And that is going to have the potential to make a lot of the contamination airborne. A fence, I don't know that a fence will help. And it depends on what kind of fence we're talking about. Committee to Bridge the Gap, which is a brilliant technical expert team that has been working on this issue of the Santa Susana Field Lab for over 40 years, they've often recommended to the DTSC that there should be a giant circus tent, something paneled on every side and have a roof, a cover. So that way, when these sort of cleanups are being done and little parts, you know, you can actually guarantee to the community that the contamination isn't blowing off site. a fence itself, I don't know if that would be enough. They're saying that that's why humans aren't at risk, because we can't, there's a fence already there to keep humans from walking on the site. But really, that's still insufficient, because we're, you know, right now it's pouring out. We've got rainwater washing it off the site into the LA River, where it's already been noted in different permits that Boeing has exceeded that over $1 million already cumulatively for contamination getting in the LA River. It's getting into the Cayugas Creek watershed. It blows off site. And during the Woolsey fire, that mobilized the contamination. So we need something stronger than a fence. But no, a fence is, to my knowledge, a fence meant to protect contamination from blowing off site during the cleanup. To my knowledge, it is not being implemented.
Another one of Terry's questions was, should residents be masked, take live plants and pets indoors, cover lawns, trees, and shrubs to protect from what might be coming off this site, especially given our extreme weather conditions that we're experiencing right now?
Well, fortunately, there are local, state, and federal regulations. These kind of cleanups have been done before. And the whole idea is that it's supposed to make residents safer. They should not be allowing contamination to blow off site. They have dust mitigation. They have different measures to try to limit that. I think my concern as a resident and as a cleanup activist is that, you know, DTSC hasn't always followed through on all the steps that it's put in place for these. I would love to see a community monitor have access to the site to see and be able to report back to the community that, yes, they are using the dust mitigation measures. They are making sure that this isn't coming off site. So I think a lot of this comes down to the trust. You know, trust has been broken between the government agency and the community. We don't feel like they're going to keep their word to make sure the dust isn't coming off site. That doesn't necessarily mean that dust is coming off site. Does that make sense?
There's no way to know. And certainly at this moment, what's coming off site is an awful lot of water, because that's happening throughout the greater Los Angeles area.
And that we already know is happening, and we're fighting right now. In fact, we have to go to court probably with Boeing, because we fought to make those restrictions tighter in the rain runoff. And Boeing is now threatening to sue the water board because we were successful. We do know that there are air monitors put around the site during this cleanup. And those are meant to monitor to make sure that contamination isn't coming off in the dust. That is one resource. But again, is it enough to make community members feel safe during this cleanup? I don't know if it's enough. Something like a circus tent would help me feel a lot better about it. They're not willing to take those extra steps to guarantee that the community feels safe.
That's because they're still in the clown car. There are also questions about who exactly the contractor is who is doing this work. Terry had raised the question, who's the subcontractor? How many jobs have they had involving contaminated soil? And that she wrote that it looks like, from what she's read, that they're actually roofing contractors. Do you have any clarity on this?
Yeah, I was able to research them. They do ex situ remediation. They do sensitive habitat and waterway restoration, wastewater treatment, and decommissioning and demolition. So it sounds like they're qualified. But let me take you down a little rabbit hole real quick. On the cleanup that was ordered, this emergency cleanup, the DTSC only listed 20 contaminants of concern, which is insane, because we already know that this is one of the most polluted parts of the Santa Susana field lab. And the whole field lab itself has over 350 contaminants of concern. A lot of these include radionuclides, toxic metals, federally banned chemicals. I mean, it's really a dangerous, the whole site itself is dangerous, but this is one of the worst of the worst. And the DTSC is only screening for 20 contaminants to be cleaned up during this emergency remediation. But the worker paperwork that's later in the same document lists out over 50 contaminants of concern that the workers could be exposed to while they're cleaning it up. So the DTSC says only 20 have to be cleaned up, but watch out for 50 that you could get exposed to while you're there in the soil that could actually cause physical harm to you. This is the same, it's like this two-faced monster. The DTSC, every time we deal with them, they're talking out both sides of their mouth, that it's safe, it's also not safe. You know, we'll keep the workers safe, also we're just protecting the wildlife. It's so confusing and convoluted. And Delaney Blaze, who I don't know if you've met, but she works with for advocacy who helps former Department of Energy workers be able to sue to get their compensation from the federal government from working around nuclear contamination that gave them cancer up at the Santa Susana Field Lab. And she had a great point saying, well, are the workers wearing radiation monitors? To my knowledge, I don't think they are. But they're up in this burn pit where they're clearly going to be, I mean, there's radioactive contamination there. So these are, again, there's just, I feel like every time I have to deal with the DTSC, I come away with more questions than answers. That's very frustrating.
In terms of the workers, are they covered by a union? And might there be a way to go through a union to get pressure on DTSC, if for nothing else, those badges, so that they could measure radiation?
That's a great idea. I hadn't thought of that. I think I'll do that, because we saw that with the DTSC when we went on a site tour of Exide, which has lead poisoning in their community. And we saw workers without masks doing lead remediation. So my confidence in the DTSC to keep our workers safe. And these people live in our community. They're part of our community too. You know, we want to make sure our workers are safe. So that's a great idea. Thank you. I'll look into that.
Happy to help. What, if any, mechanism exists to make DTSC accountable and transparent, or at least as transparent as it's possible, to address these issues and provide reasonable, thoughtful, truthful answers to the community?
Whew. A magic fairy godmother would be a great start. You know, I think it unfortunately has come onto community members like myself, where public accountability seems to be the strongest motivator for them right now to actually have to do a good job. But that's a huge burden. You know, community groups like mine, we have very little funding, we have very little resources, and we're always scrambling to try to catch up with what DTSC is doing. But it's not just DTSC. This is the same with the Department of Energy, which is a federal agency. NASA, they have Superfund sites across America. This is something I think that's not just happening in California. There's a culture within these agencies, corporate and government, where there's just not that accountability to the community and to putting human health first.
That was also addressed in the other interview that's on today's program with Vina Colley, who's dealing with comparable issues in Ohio around the Piketon Portsmouth site. What about the media? Media is great at engendering feedback and pressure and awareness and at least building up a head of steam so that some accountability has to be thrown at them before they'll back off. How has the media coverage been?
We're very fortunate that we live in Los Angeles, so we have a lot of media coverage here. It never seems to be the nail in the coffin to get things to actually change. I don't know why. I just know that it's the continued pressure, and it's us not giving up, and it's not looking away, and it's continuing to educate the community, which is why we have that Facebook page, just try to make sure, you know, we're getting real information out to the community as accurately and quickly as possible. But again, we have to change an entire culture. These people in these government jobs, it's not just that they've made one mistake or one bad choice. This is a culture of cover-up and a culture of silencing community members. And that takes a lot to change. I think it takes more than even a whole village. I think it takes a nation of citizens bringing accountability to these types of agencies and saying, you know, our lives are valuable and they're worth fighting for, and we're not going to stop until all of our kids are safe.
Looking now at what we're facing weather-wise as being as extreme as it gets in this area, certainly a prediction of 8 to 10 inches of rain over a 3-day period of time is unprecedented in my experience. And the wind is up as well. So there's the chance for more spreading of these toxic materials. What concerns does that raise for you in the near term and then beyond?
Well, I definitely am not going to let my kids go out and play in the puddles out here. That is not a safe thing for kids in my community to do. And that's a shame, you know, that we have to be thinking about how do I keep my kids safe during weather events? Not just from the weather, but from toxic contamination. It still boggles my mind. And that's something that I know is a real issue because my daughter is a 2-time cancer survivor. You know, we've been through this and we know the harm that this type of contamination can cause. I think on the long term, though, I think that this is why we need to get more climate change activists involved into these type of fights, because sites like mine were not created for climate change. And Woolsey Fire was a climate issue. Wildfires out here, the heavy rain and the extreme winds, this is all new to our area. And we're going to see more contamination coming off site. And that means more people are going to get sick from it. That's why we need a complete cleanup. That's why it's absurd that in this opportunity where DTSC is coming into the area to do a cleanup, they're putting money towards it, they're putting workers towards it, and they're going to walk away leaving contamination behind. There's no logic involved except that Boeing will save a lot of money. That is the only thing that makes sense, is that Boeing will save money from leaving contamination behind, even though extreme weather events like this are going to continue to put that contamination into the community until it's cleaned up.
Of course, they'll be able to point to it and say, see, we did what we were supposed to. Why are you still complaining?
Exactly. We absolutely believe that's what's going on here. And then, of course, this is one of the most contaminated portions of the site. So they told us verbally they'll come back and do a good job later, enough to protect human health. But, you know, that's about as good as the paper it's written on, right?
What are you and Parents Against Santa Susana Field Lab doing moving forward in response to this lackluster, is about the tamest term I can think of for it, response to your concerns and the need for a full cleanup?
We still have the fight for the rest of the site's cleanup and potentially for DTSC to come back to this area and finish cleaning it up later. We had a big document come out called the Programmatic Environmental Impact Report, which is a mouthful. And that document is going to allow Boeing to walk away from 90% of its obligations to clean up the site. Department of Energy and NASA will be able to leave 65% of their acreage contaminated. It's absurd. I can't even tell you how helpless I feel. It's not like I can move away. I live less than 3 miles from this site. And knowing that that is their intention with the approval of our government is very difficult, but we're trying to organize and we're trying to get the community to put pressure on our elected officials. There could be a lawsuit to open up that document again, to break the agreement with Boeing and to make sure that the community's health comes first and that all the contamination gets moved. It's going to cost Boeing a lot of money to do a complete cleanup. So they're going to fight it. They're going to fight it tooth and nail because they don't want to pay for it. And we've seen that Boeing seems to think that they're above the law. You know, we've seen that with their airplane. They don't think that safety and human health and human lives are very valuable. But we know the value of our community and of our children's lives. And so it just seems impossible to make real change, but we're going to fight like hell for it.
When are you running for office?
Oh gosh, that is not my strong suit, but people are.
Excellent. Let me know about that so I can feature it on the show. What can we do, listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat, and those who are definitely in alignment with you and your concerns and your neighbors and your children and all the rest? What can we do to support you?
Well, that would be fantastic. We could use the support. If you live in Los Angeles or Ventura County, you can contact your board of supervisors and ask them to clean up the site. If you live in California, you can write to the governor and say you're concerned about our site and all the other toxic sites in California, because they are numerous. And if you live across the nation, you know what would be great? Is we actually have an Emmy-nominated documentary following our story called In the Dark of the Valley. It's streaming on Peacock. Invite a few friends over and watch that, just to get the conversation going that this is happening in America. And it's not limited to just our site here in California. This is a systemic problem. And we need to start making changes. And that change, I believe, starts with conversation and knowledge.
And you're a great conveyor of both. Melissa Bumstead, you've been doing great, passionate, ferocious work on behalf of yourself, your family, your daughter, your neighbors, and ultimately all of us. I only live 30 miles away from Santa Susana Field Lab, and when the wind blows in the right direction, I know all things are possible. So I want to thank you with deep gratitude for the work you have already been doing, and especially for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, I'd like to thank you for this podcast, because I believe the first step of people making a change is knowing about the problem. And that's what you're doing. You're helping bring this information out to people And that's where change starts. So I'm very, very grateful for you and this podcast.
Thank you. Melissa Bumstead, founder of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab. We will have a link up to their Facebook group on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 659. As you heard, Santa Susana Field Lab and Boeing are yet another nuclear circus, with lots of pro-nuke folks crammed into the clown car, but without the tent. But a tent is actually a great idea and has already been used in nuclear cleanup. We've just heard from Joni Ahrens with Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety in New Mexico that they used a movable tent with HEPA filtration during the Los Alamos National Labs remediation. Why not here? That tent is probably too contaminated to reuse, but another one could be made. To help Boeing understand this option and how easy and cost-effective its implementation would be, and how much it would help people in the local community who otherwise would be potentially exposed to radioactive dust, Nuclear Hot Seat did some research. On the website, we've linked to just two of the companies that make circus tents. Maybe Boeing could use this information? It would be a lot better than keeping that clown car running.
Activist shout out.
We note with sadness the passing of Tom Bailey, who is considered to be the nuclear conscience for Hanford Downwinders, a relentless voice for thousands of people in eastern Washington state who were blanketed with radiation by the government without being told about it. Bailey pushed the press and the government to acknowledge the effects of radiation on his community. A fearless advocate for nuclear safety, he even appeared on an episode of Firing Line, a public television program hosted by conservative commentator William Buckley. Bailey will sadly be missed. He was 76 years old. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 6, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat every week and not miss a single episode, we make it easy. Sign up for it to be delivered to you via email by going to nuclearhotseat.com. You cannot miss the yellow opt-in box. Just put in your first name and an email address, and every week you'll get one email with a link to that week's show and a short description of its content. You can also sign up for notifications on your podcast platform of choice, but this way it gets into my database and then from there into Google's algorithm, which helps the show get seen by others. Whichever you do, please listen every week because all of these stories are ongoing and cumulative. Speaking of which, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help and appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Nuclear Hot Seat, and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program and the website. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that when it comes to nuclear, not only can what you don't know hurt you, chances are it already has. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.